Welcome to Archetypes and the Planets, where Jenny Montgomery and I, Bea Gonzalez, invite you to think metaphorically as we explore how we have collectively translated the map of the sky into our mythologies, religious systems, and personal psychology. Hello, everybody. I am back at Archetypes and the Planets after a long hiatus, and we have a little change. Before, I had Andre Carr, who some of you may know is my brother, on board to work with me on this, but he is extremely busy over at his YouTube channel called Proactive Astrology, and so I encourage you, if you're not already doing this, to go follow him there. I will drop in from time to time to have a conversation with him, but in the meantime, I am so excited to welcome Jenny Montgomery on as my new co-host. I found Jenny Montgomery through the wonderful podcast called With an Orb with Jen Sart, and I just immediately connected to what Jenny was saying on that particular podcast and what her interests were. And so I reached out to her, and thankfully for me, she responded. So Jenny, welcome to the Archetypes and the Planets world. I'm so glad to have you here.
I'm so excited, Bea. I've been a fan of your stuff on Twitter for a long time, and I always wondered who was behind this stream of wisdom that was, and you know, actually worth reading on social media.
It's so interesting because, you know, I was thinking about that today. I actually asked all these followers I have. I have no idea who's real or who's not, you know, how social media is. I started that in 2011 as a way of archiving my own quotes, because I was reading so much. I had no intention of having followers or anything. Then people sort of started asking me questions and recommendations for books. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. And what really heartened me was people were interested in this stuff, you know, because generally these places are places where people seem to argue all the time. And what I post really, you know, some people may question it. I just ignore it. So it was really heartening, frankly. And then, of course, I moved to Instagram and other places. But it was just because I wanted a filing system. That's why I started that for my reading.
Yeah, but it's an extraordinary archive. And, you know, and I don't look very often at social media, but, you know, a few times a week I might pop in. And oftentimes I would see a quote that was really fitting for the moment that right. I was looking through. So it has that kind of oracular quality. Yes. That even
that's great. That's just great. It's also connected me to some wonderful people. I wouldn't have met you in a way if, I mean, the fact is I approached you, you said, oh, I know you through social media. And, you know, the other podcast I do with Jay, again, I met him through social media. So it can connect people who are living in very different places, which I love, because some of what I'm interested in, frankly, not many people are interested in my immediate environment, even though I've created a group, et cetera. So, but what I want to know is, I was so fascinated when I heard you speak to Jen Sart. I just thought it was such a great interview. In fact, I think I listened to it twice. Like I listened that again. How did you end up, please tell everybody the story because I find it fascinating. How did you end up researching, actually even thinking about doing a PhD on a medieval astrologer, requiring you to learn a completely different language, not an easy language. I speak Spanish. That's an easier language to learn. Tell us that story because I'm just so intrigued.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how all of us are kind of feeling our way in the dark toward an authentic life path. And, you know, all the conditioning or, you know, the assumptions or the kind of false ideas that in the first half of life we're chasing after rainbows. But astrology was always there in the background from my childhood. It seemed like books would show up in my parents' house. They were pretty big readers. And I don't know whether people gave these to me as gifts, but I had children's books in the 70s, which were illustrated and were about the zodiac signs. And I, you know, they've gone now, but some of them were very beautiful. And I used to just carry them around and talk to people about their sun signs as a young kid. And then in the eighth grade, I was given a small computer, just a little LED computer called the Zodiac. That would have been maybe 1988. No, 82 or 83. And I would sit in the halls in junior high and do charts. But, you know, I felt like this wasn't a real thing that a person could do. I've got to do something else, So I studied journalism, I studied writing and history at the Evergreen State College, and then moved to New York City in my early 20s. And astrology was always there, but it was kind of like, it would just peek out and try to get my attention and try to get my attention. And the East Village in the 90s was a tough, it was a tough place to be. And I was going through a difficult period where roommates of mine had AIDS. Some of the brightest and most beautiful people were dying young in those days, you remember. And I was struggling, and a customer of mine, where I was a waitress in an organic vegetarian restaurant, said, "You should go see Amanda, our, the astrologer of the East Village, Amanda Gallagher." And she was quite a personage who she lived up kind of up on the penthouse of like a little six-story apartment building, and it was like the observatory up there. And she became my teacher. I went to her, and she was so helpful. I believe I had Pluto conjunct my moon. And so it was, dealing with death in my in living situation. So she became a teacher, and then NCGR was there in New York City. So I was able to access conferences and whatnot. And I was getting into grad school to study comparative literature. But this was the era of really hardcore post-structuralist theory. And I was like, wait, where's, I love literature. What's happening here? So it just wasn't, that wasn't really suitable to my temperament. I wanted to engage with language. And I found a book about Islamic calligraphy around that time. And it was like a psychedelic experience. I just fell into this coffee table book of Islamic calligraphy, and something told me, like, oh, you need to learn this language. And it brought back a memory of backpacking around Alexandria, Egypt, when I was probably 19 or 20, and getting off. I came by boat from Athens. So, again, it's this kind of foreshadowing. It was like, why am I following this trail? And coming into Alexandria and seeing, the first thing I remember is the numbers on the license plates, and starting to write down and make notes and interpret the numbers. And so fairly soon I had the opportunity to take an Arabic class at Columbia through the consortium, because I was at CUNY. And then I ended up just sliding over to that department. And I was so lucky to work with George Saliba, a historian of science who's made some incredible breakthroughs in the history of astronomy, and showing how the Copernican theories were foreshadowed and prefigured by Islamic astronomers. And so, anyway, he was really supportive of my interest in the history of astrology, and he suggested a manuscript that hadn't been fully translated. So I began to look into this 11th century guy who lived in Cairo. He was an astrologer and physician to the caliph, named Ali ibn Ridwan. So he's a colorful character that I spent a couple of years with, and I had a Fulbright to go to Cairo, Oxford, Istanbul, and Germany to dig up his, copies of his manuscript. And so this was a great adventure. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that was like, I have Jupiter Venus in the ninth. So that was like, I had eclipses during those couple of years across the third and the ninth, and it was just fantastic. And so Jupiter Venus gave me the money to go, and I had great enjoyment doing that. Although I'm so Sagittarius, Mars and Sag on the ascendant, and it's like, kind of once I figured it out, it's like, okay, I want to move on. But the Saturnian process of sitting down to write up everything and do every footnote, write your dissertation in 10 minutes a day with
I could have used that. It might have allowed me to finish mine.
it was basically like, if you can sit down and work for 10 minutes, you'll probably keep going. And so, yeah, so with the aid of that book, and yeah, I was working almost full time. So it took a couple years, but Saturn work paid off, and it was really a good thing to discipline all of my Sagittarian impulses and to learn to question my hypotheses and whatnot.
That's such an incredible story. It's interesting to me that I was sort of while you were doing that in New York, I was wandering around London, trying to pursue a PhD in the history of medicine. Not getting very far because in those days, if you remember the early 90s, one of the problems was you couldn't really find any kind of job. So I'm getting into debt in London, thinking, what am I doing? Even though I love the subject. But even though I have Jupiter rising, and one of my problems I have is my inability to focus. So when you talk about the Saturn, I have a strong Saturn, but I didn't really have quite it in me to pursue right to the end. And to this day, and we're going to talk about this with respect to you as well, I kind of laugh because at the Wellcome Institute for the History of Medicine, which has now been closed and incorporated to, at the time it was also part of the University of London, but now it's totally not there. Sonu Shamdasani was doing his PhD
Oh.
on yoga, on
Oh
that
my.
whole yoga stuff. And I never met him. And I'm thinking, wow, we crossed paths.
Wow.
Because I mean, I'm a big admirer of what he's done and how he's brought Jung into the conversation, which is where I'd like to go with you. I mean, here we both are in history. Yours had more of a relationship to astrology. Mine at the time, like you, I had found it through my brother. He was interested, and I always read it. And I read it through the work of primarily Liz Green. I really loved and Howard Zaspertas and all of the people that started out in the 80s who were really, really into that Jungian. They were also Jungian analysts. And I know that people have some quarrel with some of what Liz Green has written here or there, but in general, I find her work to be incredibly solid in terms of that Jungian piece. And so I actually found Jung through astrology, weirdly, because I started thinking, wow, this archetypal world, this is what I'm really interested in. I was actually less interested in the divinatory part, although of course that's always fascinating, but more about what this was telling me about the way the world, our internal world and our external world, was organized. And that really captured my imagination. So how did you find Jung? Was that sort of the same process, or how did it
I
come about?
began to be exposed to, well, I was always interested in psychology, and there were very terrible little bookstores like in the mall when I was
Right.
a kid. I would go to the mall and get, a book of
Yes.
psychology. But at Evergreen, I had a wonderful art instructor, and we did these interdisciplinary courses. So you didn't take six different courses, you did this big interdisciplinary deep dive with,
Right.
like, 20 people, and it was very earnest and intense. And so Jung figured very largely in her process. And we did, what is it, Ira Prokof's
Oh, yes.
journal workshop. So this, all of Marilyn Frasca's students learned the journal process. And it was extremely intensive. And it's designed around the topography of the psyche that Jung created. So I got oriented to that around age 19. But I think also I'm trying, it's kind of dim, but I think Liz Green's books, maybe the first ones that I got, were relating.
Me too. Yes, that's
And
it.
yeah, relating and Saturn. The Saturn
Right.
book I have here is just tatters. It's in tatters. I
Yes,
think about it.
it's classic, wonderful
It's
book.
so classic. And I recently got her book about the psychological defenses,
Yes,
which is like,
boundaries and barriers is fabulous. Yeah, fabulous. Yeah.
so this was and then I think it was more towards my 40s that I went into that kind of midlife examination, and I started to really read James Hollis, Marion
Yes.
Wooden, Esther Harding, and to actually look more at the women that were around him. And then I got into analysis, which, it's almost like having a guide to, go read this article, go read this part.
Yes. Yes.
Time for the, it's time to read about the animus and things
Yes.
like that. So, and then I did, lots of continuing education,
Yeah, me too.
just courses that I could do online
Right.
or
So
available.
it's interesting because I was writing my second novel and I started analysis then formally, and I did a lot of analysis. enough that I considered actually becoming an analyst, which I think happens to everybody who enters
So did
Jungian
I.
analysis. It's like, oh, I should become one. And then she was actually fantastic. She said, your real gift in the way we talk, and then what you're very interested in these ideas. You might be better. We need people to work with groups, and would you be doing that? And she also knew that, I had small children and I was trying to write a novel, the usual juggling way too many things. And it turned out to be the thing for me personally, because I continued. Toronto has a great Jungian community, so I did tons of, I did Marion Woodman workshops. I'm very privileged that she was there. I even James Hollis would come to town quite regularly. I brought him in myself in 2010 to work with my group. So there was a lot of access to this kind of ongoing education, for which I'm extremely grateful. But I realized that my path was not one-on-one. And so it was helpful to have somebody guide me in that way. But it left with me this incredible thirst that's just still not gone to read all about this. I mean, of course, my interests have expanded and gone to other places. But, for example, we have in Toronto Inner City Books, which has produced this incredible collection of books written by Jungian analysts. And it's just a treasure trove if you're interested. And, especially if you want to be interested in things that, or are interested in things that are a little bit more specialized. Like, I think always of Edward Edinger writing about Moby Dick. It's a fantastic book, right? And you think, oh, well, it's only Moby Dick. But you know what? It's not. It has so much more to say.
I just
And
got that book for my son.
you'll love it. He'll love it, and you'll love it. And it'll be great conversation with him, because again, that's such an important novel in so many different levels. But to see it from the perspective that Edinger, the context he gave it, here's the thing. When you talked about comparative lit, and I did some of that as an undergrad before I switched to history and medicine. And I one of the things that was interesting to me is that sometimes studying it can deprive it of its power in a way, the way that it was being taught. You're right, with this post-structural, there's it was something I couldn't relate to. But reading someone like Edinger, for me anyway, reconnected me to that book in a way that I don't think it could have been in a dry academic kind of way, at least for me. I know there's many different
Very
approaches.
soulful, very
Yes,
soulful.
yes.
There was this kind of I mean, I didn't have the language at the time for animus and anima, but there was this desiccation of the soul
Right.
of the things that we were reading, and this it was painful. It was
Yeah.
almost like being twisted into some sort of confining garment or
Right.
something. But so Bea, I'm curious how you see in your chart this group work. Is it your 11th house
Yes,
planet, your
for sure.
sun?
I, yeah, not only that, but the Capricorn 11th house. I really find that not only am I have a group, but I lead it, I organize it, and then I organize groups online almost by creating it. Yeah, it's important to me to have dialogue. I don't, I will, and it also is important to me. Like, I could have gone back, and I guess I did quite a bit of leading through an organization that would take people abroad, and I really enjoyed that. But at some point, I thought I have to have a group where these conversations can happen on the level that incorporates some of the Jungian ideas. In other words, it brings in that soul part, which sometimes, even when I was doing other programs, were much more in the literature. It was still very good, but I didn't feel, I felt it lacked something, which is I felt the only way you can do this is to create it. And all my life, I've sort of lived out my 11th house. From very young on, I was part of the United Nations Refugee Association. I was part of the History Association. I was always getting involved. I felt that that was where I came alive. Even sometimes, I remember being very young and being part of a theater group that was one of the youngest groups ever. I wasn't acting, I was just doing the organizing, but it was always something that really feeds me. And so I can only say that that's I got to be the 11th house really screaming for me, having three planets there, sort of sitting. Yeah, so for sure, I think that is the 11th house emphasis.
I admire that ability to jump into the parade of life and really be in the parade. It's
Right.
yeah, I have a Neptune Moon opposition, and my sun conjuncts that Pluto Uranus thing of the 60s, and
Right.
I think there's a little bit of an extra step for me to get out in front of people.
Interesting. Yeah. It's interesting because you still have Sag rising, which I always associate with a much more extroverted quality, right? Than, for example, my Pisces rising. But it really shows you one thing that I've really had to take into consideration is how important angular planets can be and how they sometimes really scream loudly. Because my Jupiter really screams loudly. I mean, it really, I didn't realize just how much. And then I started looking, and I don't know if you've ever looked at this particular thing, and I think it would be something to maybe discuss for a whole episode, the relationship between typology, the way that Jung created it, and how it may relate to a chart. Because I think it's super fascinating. And just for people who may not be familiar with this, Jung very early on developed this system of psychological typing, which was then appropriated, taken over by Myers-Briggs. I don't think it's a good match, but some people do, whatever. But it really is a way of telling you how you approach the world and where your missing leg is. And I think that missing leg really fascinates me because I think it tells us a lot about what we need to incorporate into our psyches, into our approach. And I try to match it. I don't know if you've ever tried to do this to see, okay, how does this fall? If I look at a chart, where can I see the missing link? Where can I see that? And at first I thought it was elements. I thought, well, you know, somebody's very heavy in air, they're probably a thinking type. But having worked with my group very intensely and seeing there, I don't quite think it matches just to elements. You really have to look at it carefully and see what is the predominant kind of flavor, you know. And I'm not sure there is an exact match. The way I tell them is, it's not that you have to know about typology or to know your chart, but they gives you clues as to what may help you complete some part of yourself or to the parts of the psyche that are dormant. And sometimes, you know what, it happens through transit. Something comes in and knocks you off, and hey, you got to face it. But having a little bit of self-awareness around these things or self-knowledge, I think it's great preparation. And it allows you also, because one great thing about archetypal astrology for me is the connections we make. It's not one thing, it's multivalent. You have many different meanings. So it allows you to understand something from a much richer perspective, which means you don't get stuck, right? And saying this is the only way out. Actually, maybe there's a couple ways out, and we can look at it and see what is appropriate for me. I don't know what you think about that, but
It goes back to that divinatory quality where there isn't, which is Jung's approach to the dream, is that, it may never stop giving out its meanings.
no.
And there is something in our subjective relationship to, how we're being addressed. And what that's the ultimate miracle, is that we are being addressed.
Right. Yes.
And the chart, the spotlight is shining on different areas of the chart at different times in life. So there have been times when I have been more extroverted and visible, or gone on a crusade in the community to change things and stuff like that. And now Neptune's beginning to oppose my sun by transit, and I feel myself going into a kind of a creative retreat. Where I'm working on a drawing. I'm drawing a graphic history, a comic book, and it's kind of a Jungian topic. But it feels really good to just be almost in a little monastic inner space for a couple of years, and then that will pass. And
Sure. Well, that, I mean, I think it does mark different phases. It tells you things are always changing. And it actually, for me, also tells you what has to come online sometimes, maybe disown planets that are really archetypal energies that you may be not so comfortable with. It's interesting you talk about Neptune. My first novel I wrote when I was 23, which ended up in the garbage, it was really bad, but it was great. Kind of training for me was when I had Neptune right on the sun. And I remember that whole period, I was really confused at 23 or 24. I just finished my master's in London again, and I had no idea. I was so confused. Should I go on for my PhD? Should I get a marketing job? I am completely confused. But the only thing, and this is such a Neptune thing, the only thing that kept me afloat at that time is I became obsessed with opera. And at those times, you remember those old Sony Walkmans we all walked around with? I was
Yes.
walking around everywhere, just listening to opera, taking opera courses, not as a singer, again,
Oh.
just fascinated. I was so Neptunian. It was like, oh, let me
Wow.
merge in this world. And then writing this novel, which, so that whole Neptune period, that's all. It was a foggy period. I did honestly have issues around figuring out what to do. And so my brother was always studying it and said, your problem is you have to let go. You're just too focused on getting an answer. And maybe you just need to let Neptune be a medium, and that's exactly what I let happen. So that's why I started writing, and I thought, yeah, this is what I really want to do. And then it took me some years before I actually committed to it. But I just remember Neptune as being an incredibly, in my case, an incredibly fruitful time from that creativity and the receptive to music. And which, by the way, once it disappeared, once the transit left, that feeling kind of left. It came back and forth, but I didn't have that connection anymore to the things that completely overwhelmed me at that during that period. And so I can totally see why you would be picking up and drawing. And I find highly people with Neptune very connected to their charts, either angular or connected to one of their personal planets, tend to really approach the world creatively in a way that is so interesting. It's so natural. There's a member of my group who has Neptune on the ascendant in Scorpio, or Scorpio ascendant. Neptune's right on it. And I'm always amazed that at how many different areas creatively she's able to touch. And she does it very naturally. One day she'll walk in with a painting. The next day she's playing the piano. Or she's writing a 50-page creative essay on how her divorce led to her buying a piano. It's just so natural for her. And I'm wondering, I mean, I know I don't see Neptune often associated specifically with creativity, although I know it has been. But one thing I think is it connects you so clearly to the unconscious. And this is what you're sort of distilling, when it's connected.
I had a client this week who's a visual artist and has Neptune directly opposite the sun. And the person's artwork, that they go into a flow state and it's just communicated to them. They're just listening and putting down what they hear and what they sense. And that's happening with me too. It's not particularly effortful. It feels like I'm just kind of getting out of the way, and that things that were technically difficult for me in the past are not difficult now. And there was some Saturnian preparation for that, a lot of study, but it's fascinating how it happens. There's a service, almost an aspect of being in service.
I think the biggest problem you could get into with Neptune transits, or if you have it very wired in, is to fight it. There is a little of a moment surrendering to the whatever's happening at the time, even if you don't really see the clear picture. And I do think that's a problem with Neptune. You sometimes can't see where this is going, and so you're sort of wading in water. But I trust it now. I didn't used to. That transit taught me, just sit, just be receptive, watch. And you will be frustrated. I'm a Capricorn with, three Capricorn planets. Saturn's important, so it gets a little bit frustrated. I don't know if the wonderful book by Liz Green on Neptune, which is really in depth,
Oh my God.
fabulous. So it's one of the
So
ones.
good. Yeah.
She's like a walking library. I really honestly, every time she's thought so deeply about this. And one of the things she talked about was, because I have that Neptune Saturn square in my chart.
Where?
Yeah, which is not exact, but it's there. And she talks about how many artists have that, because Neptune is the formless and Saturn is the inclination to want to bring form into something that is formless. So you're battling. It's the ultimate battle, right? How do I take something that I'm receiving, which is kind of amorphous, and put it into something that you can receive in a rational or whatever way, through whatever senses you have? And that's the struggle, and I think, and it's what keeps you going, really. Half the time I say, well, I don't want to write another novel, it's work or whatever, but there's that Saturn pushing, saying, no, you have to do it, it's part of the discipline work. Are you still, if they you're a little bit younger than I am, so you probably don't have the Saturn Neptune. What's that relationship in your, because you would have a, no, you don't have Saturn in your,
Yeah, I
right?
still have Neptune in Scorpio. So yours is 14 minus 22. And my Saturn's all the way into Aries.
Into Aries, right? Okay, so you wouldn't have that. It's an inconjunct. Yeah, it's really interesting though, just how those two can work. I mean, anything can work. It's not the just those two in general, but the idea of form versus the formless. And I think those two are great representatives of both, which is why I think, remember when the Saturn Neptune was happening in 2017 and everybody was talking about boundaries and borders, and you had the whole boat people situation in Syria, that all these poor people ending in boats and
Refugees.
ending up in Greece. It was horrible, right? And people getting really angry, and it's like, are you kidding? I mean, the compassion, because I don't know if you associate, but I think Neptune is also the ability to kind of tap into something a little bit deeper and perhaps more compassionate. And so Saturn opposing or squaring kind of just pushes some people to want to erect boundaries against it because they feel overwhelmed, and obviously I think this is an inner problem being projected possibly into the outer world, which is what we're doing all the time. This is not unusual. But when you see it in the sky like that, and you're looking at the world, you're seeing why these themes keep coming up and why it's important. And I don't know what you think about this. I think Jung's greatest value to me is he keeps reminding you, we can form groups, we can do whatever, we can go and we can scream at the top of our lungs, please fix this, please fix that. But the ultimate work is inner work on yourself, so you are at least not adding to the damage, and that you're able to see things with a little bit more distance, discernment. It's something that I often post in my social media accounts, and I get a lot of pushback. They say, "Well, does that mean we don't do social work?" And I said, "No, one isn't. It's not either or." But I think if you are unwilling to do the inner work, then I think the outer work isn't somehow almost driven by your complex nature, which it always is. I'm not saying you're ever getting rid of it. And I'm reminded of what Ram Dass said, right? That the problem with a peace rallies, he felt, was that there are a lot of angry people at peace rallies, and if we're looking to have peace, we should work on the inner peace first as a, as a first step.
Yeah, I think we should have. I would love to talk to you another time, and really dive into this work that's being done in the Jungian community now around cultural complexes and dissociation within a culture or trauma within a culture, and our dissociation around our environmental situation is so profound.
It
The
is.
inability to actually feel it. And this kind of fracturing, which we are familiar with in the individual psyche, and how neurotic and psychotic that can be, is playing out for us collectively.
Oh yes, for sure. I think it may be the biggest problem of the age. Well, it always has been. I think because societies are made up of individuals, if the individual doesn't work at some point to attain some consciousness, then everything that they can't own, they will project. And you see this in the anger, the level of division. They almost the people are getting adrenaline from going out there, and I guess they do from finding someone to oppose. And it doesn't, conversation and dialogue, which is what my group, what I strive to do with my group. Has to it means that we can have differences, but it means we don't shut each other down. We have to listen. And sometimes we get heated and whatever, but it's an important the dialogue is really where the other gets incorporated. And often, I'll tell them the chart is a good way to know where maybe you are having you're stuck a little bit to tell you why the other person is triggering you. Well, it's happening because you yourself have that unresolved note in your own psyche, and someone's just shown up to help you out. You're gonna oppose them, but they're gonna be helpful.
The chart is an incredible way to look at ourselves and see shadow material, things that are integrated. When I first started to read astrology cookbooks, in a way, it was like, oh, it's talking about all my bad qualities, and then finding out how, as a consulting astrologer, we can use humor or we can ask questions to guide people towards some recognition and acknowledgement of that. And this even came up with my 11th century guy, Ibn Ridwan, that I wrote about in my dissertation. And he had some difficult aspects, like a Venus Mars aspect, and some difficult things with the moon. And he reflected on himself, and he said, "I don't have great luck in love. I'm very lustful. I marry many women, most of them virgins and young. But because the moon is in quadrature to the sun, I abandon most of them, and I divorce many times. I am lustful, and yet I derive little pleasure from my lust." And so he's reflecting in a way on his own bad qualities and how this works out for him. And I think that's, that's not just a modern
No, that's great.
phenomenon. Yeah, exactly. To use.
That's fascinating. No, I had to, I mean, that also shows real self-awareness, especially, forget even the time he was writing and just real self-awareness, which is something that I think people do struggle with. Because as you say, when you read these books and you see the shadow qualities, the first instinct is to feel shame, which is a great way to shut yourself down and to shut others down. Instead of saying, I wonder, and this is the way I posit it to my group, I wonder if our shadow qualities, just like our inferior function, aren't holding the parts of ourselves that will actually help us go to the next level, go to the next step, and incorporate parts. And by the way, we'll free you of seeing it out there in the world and getting all hyper about this and that, It's so important. It is such a but I also have to say, and I don't know how you just actually brought up what has been said in my group as well, that it can be humiliating sometimes, right? We have to humble ourselves because we're not perfect. In fact, as we know, Marion Woodman certainly wrote endlessly about this. Perfect is actually the enemy of growth in a way because you're trying too hard. It's a masculine, the masculine side of us or the yang side of us going a little bit crazy. Imperfection is where the art lies, and that means admitting it.
Exactly. And she writes about that quality of an animus-possessed woman who is somehow frozen or unable to enter into the world and bring her warmth and her gifts and participate fully, because nothing is good enough, nothing is pure enough, but really it's an intense self-attack that prevents you from joining the dance.
And that's the really sad part. And often I think she was such an expert on eating disorders, which are rife so much. And young men too, by the way, now, not just women, but she was dealing with a lot of artists who had that background. She herself, as you know, had that background, and talking about how that is a way of get control of that her in her case, the father, as an archetypal principle, not literally as your father entering and trying to get you to points where, yes, the perfection of the body, the perfection which absolutely cuts down the human part of you, where you can have some compassion for the fact that, we're not all built the same or whatever it is. And it's really interesting because you don't see it only along those lines. You're seeing it along practically, even think about how we raise people on pedestals. This is very typical of what we do in the collective, right? And then when we find the flaw, and you will, because people are flawed, the sheer delight in cutting down this once what we thought was perfect. And actually, we created the problem, because when you elevate people to that sort of level, they can only fall. And we do this in relationships, we do it everywhere. So it does take a lot of humility to say, yeah, like I'm one of the clowns on the bus, as Elizabeth Lesser says. And once I can accept that, then I can accept the other clowns, right? Think about it. I mean, this is what we're doing. We're constantly so uncomfortable with our own inadequacies. And so I do, this is where I do think that, and by the way, the marrying of an archetypal language like astrology, right, with Jungian theory, which is also very, it's also practical. It's not just theoretical. In fact, the best work is when you're working with your dreams, or when you're working with. Let me ask you this. When you look at a chart, have you ever, because I had this idea one day just to look at a chart as a dream. If this were a dream, if this were my dream, what would it be telling me? What would this dream be telling me? What am I here for? What is, and it really gets fun because you start looking at all the things as dream characters as opposed to, these fixed things in the sky that, made Venus and my Mars are squares. So I can totally relate to that. Yeah. I don't know what you think about that.
Oh, I've never thought of that, but yes, I mean, yeah, I can completely see my Mars on the ascendant as, yeah, having coming into the world as a fighter, and it was really, there was a lot of fighting, and kids used to fight, kids used to be dangerous to walk a mile home from school and encounter bullies. And yeah, there was a lot of fighting. And then later I became, an advocate. My son has a disability and uses a wheelchair, and, we've had to fight for a lot of things. And but I think in some ways too, like my inner work in analysis has been about discovering the proper soulful use of strength. And we have a little project going here in Missoula with some people gathering to make garments in honor of the upcoming Jupiter Uranus
Oh,
conjunction.
great.
So, because it's in Taurus, and
Taurus, yeah.
so yeah, so Jupiter Uranus, it's a very catalytic energy, which we're kind of playing with stepping through that threshold in clothing that has to do with aspects of our chart. So, for my Mars ascendant, I'm making a motorcycle jacket.
Of course.
Well, I found one secondhand, but I'm embellishing it on the back with an alchemical rose image.
Oh, perfect.
And then embroidering on top of that, the beautiful sort of synodic rose of the orbit
Oh,
pattern of
yes.
Mars as seen from Earth. And it's a little,
Perfect.
when you look at it, you think it's Venus, and then it's like, oh, it's a little wonky.
Yeah, that would be
And
Mars.
red, red, right. So I'm going to kind of try to mitigate Mars with Mars, but also some Venus. The jacket is a beautiful blue color. So yeah, I think as the dream, that's almost like, yeah, the ascendant does have a lot to do with how, the like in a video game, it's like your avatar. It's like how,
Yes,
what you're coming in
yeah.
as. Yeah. So Yes.
Well, that business of the Jupiter Uranus conjunction in Taurus, I love that you are taken. I often say this to when we're talking about our dreams, that sometimes all the dream wants you to do is a little bit of a ritual that can be very particular to you to make you understand why that shadow character keeps showing up, or something that you're really saying, I am aware that the unconscious is having a conversation with me, and I'm going to honor it by bringing the inside out, just like we sometimes bring the outside in. So I love that you're actually doing something concrete, material, which is very, very earthy, very Venus, sorry, very Taurus, and that is a way to absolutely invoke part of the inner world to come outside and to have that moment of synchronicity, right? To have that moment of connection where the inner and the outer meet, which, by the way, is I think why we're all fascinated by this. At the end of the day, it's because we keep seeing that the inner and the outer meet, and those moments of complete, it's magical almost. And for me, and this is where I love Rick Tarnas's work, for example, specifically Cosmos and Psyche, is in the idea that he says we have a dead universe because the Enlightenment killed that sense of the animated universe, right? For good reason, maybe, because we had to develop along a certain path. Things are always happening for reasons we can't really fully comprehend. But by doing that, you make a whole bunch of problems that then Jung had to address in the 20th century, which is people are disconnected from a soul level, from a connected level. He kept talking about bringing the feeling function back online, the feminine. And so what I think Rick Tarnas explains so well in that book is how to reanimate the universe by saying, actually, no, this isn't a soulless place. It's actually a place where books fall out and hit you on the head. I always find it funny that within Orb, Jen Zarto is always interviewing people that had astrology books fall out and hit them on the head, right? Talk about a wake up. And so it's almost like there's something saying, look at the sign. And I always say to people, because I'm sure I'm surrounded by a lot of people with advanced degrees in sciences who think, oh, this is just crazy. And I think, it's like poetry. Poetry isn't crazy. It's another way of apprehending the world. It's another way of reading it. And just like I love science and always have loved science, interesting, you and I are both kind of ended up doing graduate work in the history of science. I can't imagine a world where you don't appreciate poetry, where you don't appreciate art, where you don't appreciate opera, right? Whatever all these things. And there's just a different way of seeing and connecting. And it's just like I think science is beautiful. Like I love astronomy. I love what it tells me. It's the idea that you're bringing in that inner and the outer and making a whole out of it. And it always amazes me that there isn't that connection for everybody. And that's fine. I mean, everybody's different, but it's just once you start looking, it just makes the thing come alive. At least for me, that's the way I look at it.
And it's, I think Jung's, he also was participating through the making of objects and creation of his stone home at
Yes,
Göttingen and the
Balingen, yeah.
carving of stone and the creation of the Red Book. I mean, these were very, they talk about Neptune, Saturn, but
Yes.
to come out of one's experience in the unconscious. And well, he was interested in magic as well.
Yeah.
And I mean, alchemy as also like the working with material in terms of its correspondence. It's almost like we're pulling a thread from the visible world into the invisible world.
Right.
And I think that it can be very, I have behind me all of my sand play figures for astrology.
Yeah.
So, I have a Venus shelf where we see, a bust of Venus and flowers and Snow White and makeup and money and
All the things that Venus represents. I love it. I love it.
yeah. And it's very helpful in astrology consultations that will actually pull out, Obi-Wan Kenobi or, for Chiron, or we'll pull out Mr. Burns from The Simpsons talking about Saturn.
That's great.
But to actually like hold that figure in your hand or to move it around the sand tray, if it's suppressing the moon or the child, or okay, maybe we're going to replace Mr. Burns now with a farmer. Or
That's so interesting, because my longtime Jungian analyst, Sophie Sinensky, had that in her practice. I'm She's an astrologer, obviously, but she would have different figures. And during different, sessions we had, sometimes I would have a dream figure that was Oh, not quite clear. And she would grab, she'd say, look for one and just see what calls to your attention. And I would just pick one up. And weirdly, I don't know how this helped, but immediately the dream became clearer. I could speak about it in a different way. And she always said, it's very important that we connect things. And sometimes by touching, by connecting in this way, then things become a little bit more alive because there's a tendency to intellectualize and to sort of get lost, you know, and in that kind of thing, thinking, at least for me. So it was really helpful. It was a grounding kind of experience, you know.
Yeah, I'm excited with the garments to see how we feel when we put them on. Because
That's true.
I want that somebody who has a 12th house sun is doing a remediation around a very visible garment with solar colors, golden colors, that's got a little shimmer to it, and someone who has is hard of hearing is creating a hooded garment that actually amplifies sound
Oh, that's
and
great.
yeah.
I think these are all great things. It's funny you mentioned Jung and all the alchemy, and for me, his later work is the one that really calls out to me because it's after his near-death experience that I think he said, I don't care anymore if you think I'm an empiricist or if you think I'm a, and he really wrote all those great works like Answer to Job and the well, I guess Ion is part of that. And I always think to myself how that division within us, right? The need to be accepted by our culture, which I think he wanted to be as a scientist, and the insistence on being an empiricist, which he was, by the way. I mean, the experience of the Red Book is a real experience, and yet the fear of being seen in a certain way, you know, that was this conflict. And it wasn't until very later in life, which actually gives me some solace because I feel the same conflict in myself. I always feel very weird about talking about this subject publicly because I'm worried about the lack of understanding, the lack of knowledge. This is a subject you and I both know takes years to understand, right? It's not something you pick up and you look at a newspaper and you figure it out. I'm always aghast that people say, well, just send me some tips. It's like, no. I've been teaching a subgroup of my general group for 3 years now. And they see how complicated this gets. This is an ongoing learning. And I mean, I'm still learning and I will learn until the last day. One of the reasons I think I like it is that there's so much to learn. But it's just this discomfort. I feel what he was feeling, the discomfort of speaking about a language that someone will counter and immediately try to denigrate by thinking they understand it, but they don't, right? And so it part of me talking about it publicly is to out myself, to be a more comfortable saying this is ludicrous. Of course, I have played with this like poetry, like, and it is important to me. So this is why I actually started this. It was a way for me to become a little bit less worried about what the world might have to say and about a subject that I care so much about you. Did you ever have that conflict at all inside?
Yes, absolutely. Especially as an acad when I was in the academic world, and there were other people studying the history of science who really just overtly laughed in my face, as if this was a and Otto Neugebauer, the historian of science, called these occult topics wretched subjects, and he wrote an article called "The Study of Wretched Subjects" and defending the value of studying them because they show us how people thought. But I was kind of in disguise, in the academic. Now there are many more practicing astrologers who are active in academia, and it's fantastic
It is. It is
because,
fantastic.
yeah, they are bringing so much more understanding and context to things that the early historians of astrology got wrong because simply didn't know what they were looking at. So, but I think I have been, I think during my Chiron return, I mean, I've been consulting since the mid 90s, since I was, 20, in my late 20s consulting. But around my Chiron return, I was really much more of a, fuck it, fuck what other people think. This is really, this is the best, this is the thing I do best. And this is actually why I was here in the first place. So I think, yeah, owning it a bit more, and then also coming into community. I live in Missoula, Montana, so we have a smaller astrology community here, but branching out, connecting remotely with my people has been phenomenal because we can collaborate to do work, to try, old techniques, to learn from other people, see things, and it's just the greatest joy.
That's exactly why I am so grateful. I know a lot of people talk about social media and the internet. It has definite issues, but I think we also have to focus on the fact that it also brings people together who may never have met each other otherwise, and who share a passion that, other people around you physically may not share. It doesn't, we have different types of relationships. So I'm immensely grateful for the fact that we are living in a world where I can talk to you from Toronto, and we can have this conversation. And I'm looking forward to more conversations on this. Why don't you tell people where they can find you, since you are a consulting astrologer and they may want to reach out to you? Where do you have a website, or should I put in
Yeah,
the
my website is Jenny Montgomery.com.
Okay. You know, it
And
doesn't matter, because I actually, now that I think about it, Jenny, I'm going to be linking that anyway to the
oh,
whole
great.
podcast, so they can find it
Yeah.
directly through the link in the podcast.
Sure. And we can also share the link to a little write-up I did about the Garmin project if people want to follow along.
Perfect. Love
Yeah.
it. Yeah, I think people would like, I think it's a great idea. I think it might be something, because I think that conjunction is happening between about April 18th and April 8th, 26th, around that area. So people still have time, if they want to create a
Yes.
garment. So it
Yeah.
might be an invitation for people to do that, to just say, okay, how, what would I create? Because when you said it, I had to think about it. Like, wow, what would I be creating? Because you're using it just to give instructions. You are, I'm sure they'll be in that write-up, but it is for remedy. In other words, you're trying to bring something that you're having trouble with to light. Is that the idea, or?
Yeah, I think we often go to astrology in sort of an extractive way. What am I going to get, or what's going to be good for me? What's going to go well? But to look, I mean, when you really look at the most painful things in your chart, there's such tremendous value again in feeling the feelings of a Chiron placement, or feeling the feelings of a Neptune moon that doesn't feel seen. It's like, so that was the invitation. It's like,
That's great.
let's really go into that and then think about Jupiter Uranus as a catalyst for insight and a catalyst for change or revolution, even in some difficult part of our lives.
That's great. You know, when you said that, I'm thinking of, I don't know if you've read Raphael Kushner's book, The One Thing Holding You Back, which is one of the many books talking about feeling the feelings. So this is maybe the thing that most holds people back, and that they're covering it up, and we don't really get into our bodies enough to be able to express and to understand, like just working with things like grief. It takes time, but to really feel it in the body, it's such a key aspect of the whole thing. Okay, Jenny, we will talk next time, I hope, about many other things.
I'm
We'll see
so
where it takes us.
excited, Beba.
Me
Thank
too.
you for
So much
having me.
fun. So much fun.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening. If you would like to support our podcast and you like what you're hearing, please go over to any of the places where you download it and leave a review. That helps other people find us. To find us personally, you can find me at sophiacycles.com, and you can find Jenny Montgomery at jenny-montgomery.com. Links are all in the show notes. Until next time.